Coming up on Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway, we talk with Ryan Steele in the occurrence of bare-chested men on Broadway. Please stay with us.
Now is the time to seize the day.
Answer the call and don't delay.
Answer the call and don't delay. Wrongs will be righted. If we're united, let us seize the day.
Now let them hear it loud and clear.
Now let them hear it loud and clear.
Like it or not, we're drawing near.
Like it or not, we're drawing near. Proud and divided, we'll slay the giant.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, January 20th, 2013. My name is James Marino, and the broadcast this morning we have Michael Portantier and Laura Mata and Aileen McKenna from the Craptacula. Laura and Aileen write that wonderful website, the Craptacula, which is, how would you describe it, as a gawker of Broadway? Is that accurate?
Sure. I would say that it is a snarky take on Broadway with a lot of chatter about good-looking men.
All righty. And that was Laura, Aileen. Laura.
Or,
that was Laura. I thought that was, but
yep.
You two are like peanut butter and jelly. Sometimes I mix you up. So also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and an essayist and a photographer. He writes for BroadwayStars.com. He also writes for outlets such as the Sondheim Review. He also has a website called Follow Spot Photography at followspotphoto.com, where you see lots of great photography there. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
This morning, Ryan Steele is joining us. Of course, we know Ryan from his Broadway career, where we have seen him in West Side Story. We saw him in Billy Elliot and Newsies. And coming up, you have Matilda. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And also, aside from Matilda, you have a film coming out, which is called Five Dances. So, Ryan, before we jump all over about the Broadway stuff, tell us about Five Dances.
Five Dances is an indie film. It's directed by Alan Brown, directed and written by Alan Brown. You guys may have heard of him. He did Private Romeo last spring, I think it came out.
Yes.
He's an awesome guy. He's really talented. And, yes, he's sort of this film is sort of an unconventional coming of age. And it has to do with dancers living in New York City, and I'm one of the five dancers.
Great. So we're going to put a link for the trailer coming up on our show notes, but why don't you tell us a little bit about how long you've been involved with the project and how did, I mean, it sounds like you have a very busy schedule. Did you film this in between all your other stuff or did you take a break?
Yeah, it was sort of weird how it all worked out. The auditions were just an open call. My agent sent me in for it. It was in October of last year. And then I found out I got it the second audition, which was the final callback. And we were sort of just chatting with the director for a bit, and then we finally started filming in January of last year, so about a year ago, and it was right after I closed Billy Elliot, I think on the 6th or 7th of January, and then the next day I started rehearsals for Five Dances, and then the day after we finished Five Dances, we went into rehearsals for Newsies. I don't know how it worked out so perfectly, but I got really lucky.
Wow.
That's how life is.
Now, your character is not a Broadway show dancer, right? He's a classical...
He's a modern dancer. He grew up with classical training, but he's sort of thrown into the pickup company, small modern dance world.
Yeah, it looks the trailer looks really interesting. I noticed, if this isn't too personal a question, in the film, apparently his family is very much not supportive of his career.
That's right.
I hope that's not your situation.
No, I'm the complete opposite. I'm really lucky. My parents and my siblings get here as often as they can to see me in shows. And my oldest sister lives in Queens with her husband and two daughters, and they love to come see me in shows. It's awesome. It's great.
Oh, that's great.
You say they get here from where?
Michigan.
Michigan? So you're a Michigan baby?
I am, yeah, just outside of Detroit.
Did you go to U of M?
I didn't. No, I moved here right after high school for West Side Story.
Oh, my God. You're 12, aren't you?
Yes, you were the baby of that company, weren't you?
I was, yeah, baby John.
more ways than one.
That's awesome. I love that. I love that.
Yeah, I was pretty fortunate. I had awesome people around me to teach me. You know, I say that I got my BFA at the Palace Theater. I learned a lot.
How did you get from there to here? Did you come here with a job, or did you come here looking for a job?
I actually moved here with a job. Like I said, my older sister lives in Queens, so it was really helpful during auditions, having to come back and forth a lot. And I was here for a workshop, a week of workshops and classes and stuff. So I just went to the open call for Westside on the way to the airport. and yeah, then four or five callbacks later, I found out I got it. And so yeah, I had that security of a job when I moved here. I'm so grateful for that. I don't know where I would be if I hadn't had that.
And yeah, and it seems like you've just gone from one to the next.
Yeah. I'm pretty lucky. I'm having fun.
How long were you in Billy Elliot?
Let's see, Billy Elliot, I did double duty with Westside for 7 weeks. So I was in rehearsals for 7 weeks starting in November and then of 2010. And then I left in, I think, August 2011 to do Newsies over at Paper Mill. So altogether about 8 or 9 months.
Wow.
And so how was that, the Newsies experience? Tell us about that.
Oh, man, Newsies. Today's actually my last show with Newsies at 3 p.m., so I've been pretty nostalgic for the past few days. Newsies is so special to me. I learned a lot, and I met some of the best people in the world. And, I mean, it's Newsies. Being a male dancer, that's like it for me. You know, I was that 10-year-old in my living room making up dances to Seize the Day and Carrying the Banner and King of New York. and yeah, it's awesome. It's my passion project. I've only been here for 4 years, but this is, other shows are going to be hard to measure up. This has been pretty wonderful.
But did you also know as a kid, did you know West Side Story? Cause that's the other male dancer.
Yeah. Everest. Yeah. I totally did.
Yeah. So you got both of them already. Heavens.
I know, yeah. It's been pretty fun.
So today's your last day at 3 o'clock. This show won't go out until after your last show is out. So dish about Newsies. Tell us. No, I'm kidding. How when Newsies started up at Paper Mill and then was well-received and subsequently moved to Broadway, I mean, Disney, from the public side, kept on saying that, you know, oh, this is going to be, you know, it's just Paper Mill. We're going to see what happens. Oh, New York, we're just doing New York for 100 performances. Oh, we're going to extend. Now we're going to do an open run. I mean, from the inside track, did you feel uncertainty or were they whispering to you guys, everything's good, we're Disney?
You know? No, I think Disney is so brilliant, and they were a wonderful company to work for, and their marketing strategies, I think, are really smart. I mean, obviously, we're pretty successful. We were sort of really in the dark, the cast, and I think a lot of our creator team even were sort of in the dark. When we left Paper Mill, we didn't know anything. It was kind of sad and scary to perform our last show at Paper Mill because we didn't know when the next time, or if there was a next time, we would be doing it, you know? And then even when we heard up about the Thanksgiving Day Parade for last season, when we did in New York on the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, we still didn't know I think the Broadway announcement had come out, but we didn't know if we were going to Broadway. So it was a few months of us individually were going to Broadway. So it was a few months of uncertainty that was sort of scary.
Wow. I guess your pirouette has become famous. media. Didn't you do it twice? Because didn't you do it on the parade and also on the Tonys? Am I right?
We did. Let's see. Not on the parade because we did King New York, but I did do it on the Tonys, and we've done it on The View, and I did it on Dancing with the Stars.
I know. I have seen it more than once on TV.
Yeah, it's all over YouTube.
I guess that's like a do your pirouette, Ryan. Okay.
Yeah.
But that pirouette like stops the show. I mean, that I've never seen that before, where that one move literally people like got out of their seats for that.
It's true.
When it goes well.
Well, I've never seen you screw it up, and I've been there a few times, so.
That's good. I'm glad. Sometimes it doesn't go so hot.
What would you say is your success rate, Ryan?
I'd say, I kind of get in funks. So sometimes I have a good week, sometimes I have a bad week. It sort of changes.
So, Ryan, tell me about your days in Michigan when you were growing up. At what point did you make this decision that you're going to become a performer? How have you been dancing since you were very young, or how did this all transpire?
Sure. So my family sort of all danced recreationally. My sister was in classes. My brother was even in the TAF class. My mom and dad were both in parent classes. So I was sort of thrown in. I didn't really want to, but everyone was doing it. So I jumped in, and my dance studio, the Dance Dynamics Performing Arts Center, was in Walled Lake, Michigan. It's 3 minutes away from my house. It was so convenient, and it was just a second family over there. Everyone was so supportive and so encouraging. And, yeah, I just fell in love with it after one class. And I studied all different kinds of dance, jazz, tap, ballet, hip-hop. And I didn't really do musical theater until I moved here. Singing and acting was sort of just a second thought. It shouldn't have been. I regret that, but it was. The moment that I realized I wanted to do it is when I realized that you could get paid to do it, like you could actually live off of dancing. I did the Radio City Christmas Spectacular when it was in Detroit. And yeah, I remember seeing like these 20-somethings doing what they love for a living and traveling the country and making money doing it. And I thought that was the coolest idea ever.
Well, I mean, it seems to have been a very much a storybook success for you so far, but we want to point out that you worked really hard to get where you are. I mean, you know, those pirouettes don't come by just fooling around, you know?
Yeah, it was a lot of hard work, and I had some awesome teachers growing up, and I focused a lot on ballet, which is, I think, really important for all dancers.
And Ryan, did I actually hear too that you actually almost took a job with a ballet company in Texas? I mean, I thought that was really interesting. I mean, I guess, do you see yourself as potentially being able to go back to the ballet world someday, or are you kind of like on Broadway to stay at this point?
That summer after my senior year was really stressful. I decided to take a year and see what was up and not apply for schools. And when all of my friends were getting into schools, I was freaking out. And then, sort of within a week, I got a contract with Ballet Austin, and then I got Newsies. Not Newsies, West Side Story. So I'm sort of learning to not say no to anything just because you can't in this business. You never know where it's going to throw you. I didn't know that I would end up in New York so quickly. I didn't know that I would end up doing musical theater. I guess to answer your question, I could very it's very possible that I'll end up doing ballet again, but right now I don't see it, but I'm not going to rule it out.
Laura and Aileen had some great questions that they sent to me before we started recording this morning. So, Laura and Aileen, let me turn it over to you two, and you can rapid fire hit him up because we've covered we've covered some of them. But I want you guys to get the questions out that you had prepped. Aileen,
hey,
do you want me to go first, Laura?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yay! So I've watched the Five Dances trailer like 700 times, and all the fangirls that read our site have too. And we're kind of wondering, in that you're giving a performance that really anchors the piece and not as a dancer, but as an actor. So what was it like to do work that was so focused on acting more even than like your Broadway roles have been? Did you like it? What was it like?
Yeah. First off, thank you. That's really sweet. and I loved it. When I first got the job, I was sort of terrified. But I like to do things that scare me. I think that's when you learn the most, and that definitely rang true for this experience. I had a lot of trust in the director and the rest of the team, and I think that's why it went well. I was in good company. The other four dancers who were on screen had little to no acting experience. One of them was sort of our go-to actress. She has a degree in acting, but the rest of us had little to no experience. So it was sort of wonderful to all go through that together. And I think having that that support was really helpful. And we weren't afraid to ask questions, and we weren't afraid to throw out ideas, and it was just an awesome environment, and I think that definitely played into the performances that we spat out.
Awesome. So then, now that you've done some more acting, do you have any kind of dream role in mind that you would love to play at some point in your career?
Every time I get asked this, I have no idea what to say. If you were to ask me 5 years ago, I think I would say something in West Side Story, and if they ever bring music to the stage, then something in that. So I need to think of a new dream role.
Yeah. So basically your options at like 23, you're done.
I need to think of a better answer to that. I do have an answer. I think something... It's not really a role, but I would love to do something along the lines of a moving out sort of thing. That was the first Broadway show that I saw, and I was like drooling in the back. It was amazing. So I would love to be a part of something like that.
Would you like to work with Twyla Tharp specifically?
Yeah, I would. I like her work. I don't know her as a person, and I'm sure it'd be great, and I'm sure I'd learn a lot.
That also kind of makes me wonder too, you know, you were the dance captain in Newsies. I mean, a piece like Moving Out, I think of as being so kind of choreography driven and choreographer driven. And mm-hmm. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I think of it as being sort of so choreography driven and so choreographer driven. And, you know, is it something that, do you want to do your own choreography? Do you want to direct? Like, is that something that you want to do? Cause you were the dance captain in Newsies. So you are already kind of in like a leadership position. Do you want to go kind of a couple steps further with that?
Yeah, I do. I think, I know that that's not going to happen for quite some time, but I think that I would love for it to happen. Chris Catelli is one of my heroes. He's not only brilliant on stage, but he's the best human being off stage. And working with him was really inspiring. And I would love to sort of follow in that path.
Because it was funny, I think watching you in Newsies, one of the things that was kind of so amazing was that, you know, when you took your bows at the end, you got applause like you were like one of the, you know, the major principals in that show. Because I think, you know, everyone responded so strongly to your dancing in that show. I mean, how did that feel to kind of get that big, big applause at the end? Like, hey, I'm the star of this show. Like, did it feel that way?
I think I can speak for the entire cast, or the entire ensemble of Boys when I say we're all really feeling really fortunate to be a part of something that highlights dance the way it does. I think it's rare on Broadway that dance is one of the stars of the show. And even in West Side Story, Joan Robbins' choreography is iconic and it's stunning. And it wasn't, like when we walked out of the stage door, it didn't get that same response. You know, every time I leave the theater and walk out of the stage door at Newsies, dozens of comments about the dancing are thrown at me. And that is the best feeling in the world. Growing up, I mean, only being a dancer, that's my first love, you know? So being a part of something that really highlights the dancing and people appreciate it is, we're just all so grateful. And it's amazing. It's the best feeling in the world.
Great.
Random question. I wonder if you get asked this all the time in your personal life. Do you think about doing something like So You Think You Can Dance?
I do get asked that a lot. it's not for me.
Yeah.
My best friend and roommate was the runner up of season 5, I think. Jacob Carr is his name. And so I sort of vicariously experienced it through him. And, I think it's great for some people. I think the exposure is really wonderful. I just don't think it's my cup of tea.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Ryan, thank you so much for joining us. And,
yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
We look forward to seeing Matilda.
Matilda.
We didn't talk really about Matilda. You in rehearsals yet for Matilda?
I am, yeah. I started rehearsals 3 weeks ago. So I've been doing double duty with Newsies, 10 to 6 with Matilda, and then doing a show at night with Newsies. It's been a lot. but this show is going to be amazing. The kids are throwing down. They're pretty brilliant, and I think this show is really going to make its mark in New York, and I'm excited for people to see it.
It seems like it's lined up to be a huge hit. Can you maybe just tell us a little bit of how the ensemble fits into it?
Sure, yeah. So the ensemble of the show, there's, I think, 4 or 5 guys and 3 women on stage. And we play the older, scary kids in the school. We also play ballroom dancers in a dream sequence. And we also play a Russian mafia.
I didn't quite realize, I hadn't realized until I actually saw the cast list announced, how many children there are in it.
Yeah, there's a lot.
Yeah, it's incredible. The logistics of that must be so difficult. Of course, there were a lot of kids in Billy Elliot, too. But, you know, just in terms of, you know, schooling and, you know, there are all kinds of, you know, rules and regulations that become involved when children of that age are in a show. It must be very difficult.
I mean, the Royal Shakespeare Company and everyone who we're working with, our stage manager, Kelly Martindale, everyone is so on top of it that it seems pretty easy for them. You know, schedules have been really smooth and
yeah.
With schooling and rehearsal, and the kids are so hardworking. I think we're really lucky. We have a really great group of kids, and parents have been really awesome too. And so yeah, it's going really smoothly right now.
Wonderful.
Well, great. Ryan, please keep us informed as things go on. We look forward to seeing you up on stage in many, many more things beyond Matilda. But maybe after Matilda kicks off, it's going to be insane press. I mean, I guess you've been through it already once with Newsies, but the press storm of Matilda, it's got incredible anticipation from the Broadway community and the audiences. So after that all quiets down, maybe in the summer, come back and tell us how it's been, okay?
Sure, I'd love to.
All right. You have a great Sunday morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, of course. Thanks. See you later.
Bye-bye. Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye.
Ain't it a fine life carrying
was Ryan getting up on a Sunday morning and being all 22 years old and, you know, have a Broadway show, and I'm in rehearsal for another Broadway show, and I got a movie coming out, and all I can say is we knew him before he was a huge star. So we were putting together ideas about this morning's show, and we're going to do something a little bit different than we typically do. We typically talk about reviews and then talk about a little bit of news. And we will talk a little bit about reviews and a little bit about news, but maybe we could roll it up into one theme. And the theme that seems to be coming out this week is that it's all about the bare-chested men on Broadway, the bare-chested hunks. And since we have Laura and Aileen from the Craptacular, where you can see lots of photos of bare-chested men, and I can hear everybody stopping the podcast right now and going to the craptacular.com to find photographs and videos of bare-chested men in Broadway shows that are hot hunks. So Ryan was shirtless in what Newsies, was it?
He's briefly shirtless at the beginning of Newsies, and I definitely saw that show. I mean, I've seen that show
many times,
but I saw it once, and I sat next to a young woman who, the minute he came out on stage, let out an audible gasp. Once she saw him, I want to say she was about 14, and I was like, you know, a Broadway fan is born. Like, that's what it's all about, basically. I mean, whatever gets you there, that's how I feel about it.
If I recall, isn't he shirtless with suspenders?
He may be. Yes, that may be true.
Yeah, which was...
Thank you for remembering that detail.
A very nice look, yes.
I don't...
Just putting his glasses on.
Yes.
I don't really remember that. Well, when you're saying shirtless, putting glasses on with suspenders, all I can think of is... Nathan Lane in Love, Valor, Compassion.
Why do you have to ruin everything?
Sorry.
Oh. Sorry. this conversation is about.
He won a Tony for that, didn't he? So,
Well, you know, before we start, something occurred to me, and this is going to sound like a joke, but it's really true when you think about it. It occurred to me that gay men and straight women are much luckier than straight men and lesbians when it comes to this particular subject, because it's interesting. Men's and women's chests are both technically considered, I believe, secondary sexual characteristics. But as we all know, it's far more acceptable and far more common to see a bare-chested man than a bare-chested woman, except in pornography, you know, whether it's on the out on the street or on the beach or, you know, or on stage or in a film. So that's just something that gay men and straight women are just really got the luck when it comes to that, isn't it?
That's true. I mean, I also think, you know, I think if you want to see women in lingerie, you can go see Nice Work if you can get it. There's plenty of that in that show. But I think, like, I don't really like that show that much, so maybe that's why. I like Newsies a lot better.
We do have to say that for a number of umpteen years, I would say 20 years or so, that one of the biggest successes on Broadway has been the Broadway Cares Equity Fights Aid Broadway Bears, mm-hmm. where we see lots of people who go to the gym a lot who are bare torsos. So. And of course, it's a great fundraiser for Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. But we do have a number of shows on Broadway that are featuring topless men. We'll say Picnic, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, and Golden Boy that's closing today. So why don't you guys tell us a little bit about your experiences and maybe even throw in a little bit about the shows each for some of those. So, Michael, why don't you start?
Oh, okay. Well, I just saw Picnic, so I'll start with that. There has been a tremendous amount of focus on Sebastian Stan's incredible torso. And actually, it's kind of interesting with some people objecting to the fact that, and, you know, rightly so, in a way that no man who wasn't a professional bodybuilder would look like that in the 1950s. But the show is not being performed in the 1950s. It's being performed in 2000, 13, and we have different standards now. So that is what he felt that he had to do in order to make the point that this guy is he's really a sex object. And William Inge was one of the playwrights who was a very early proponent of that figure that had not previously been seen really very much at all in the theater or in film, as far as I know. But that character, the character of, to a lesser degree, but the character, the main character in Bus Stop, also by Inge, and then, of course, Tennessee Williams, most famously Stanley in Streetcar, and then Brick in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, and et cetera, et cetera. So that was something that, I guess that really came to the fore in the 50s. That was the first time, I believe, that there began to be a general sort of acknowledgement of men, as sex objects. And another thing that struck me is when watching Picnic is the character of Hal is kind of similar to, of all things, Billy Bigelow in Carousel. You know, he's a guy who's got who's used to getting along on his looks and having tremendous amounts of sex with lots of women, and but he also has a lot of anger in him, and he feels like an outsider, and he doesn't really fit in with the rest of society, and he feels somewhat lesser, and it's all about how he that expresses itself, his anger, and how he behaves throughout the course of the play. So the sex part of it, and the flesh part of it is really not gratuitous. I think it really does fit into the play. And obviously, let's see, in Golden Boy, I mean, he's a boxer, so it's obviously not gratuitous. He would be boxing without a shirt, as Seth Numerick does. And then in the case of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, the main part of the one of the main points of the play is that Brick is withholding sex from his wife Maggie for sort of several very complicated reasons, and she is very, very frustrated by that. So it's important for him to be credible as a sex object to the audience. So I would say that, in all of these cases, and also obviously Streetcar, it's not, it's important. There are important reasons for the person to be, for the male to be a sex object, rather than just in order to sell tickets.
But let's be real, most of the theater audience is women, and so it helps sell tickets.
Oh, absolutely. So it's the best of both worlds,
Yep.
You just feel better when it's not gratuitous, because then you can say, I don't know, you feel a little cleaner, I think.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting about the kind of shirtlessness in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof versus Picnic, because I think you won't see the complaint about Picnic that Ben Walker is looking like super cut and like he just walked out of the gym. I mean, I think Brick is supposed
I'm sorry, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Brick is supposed to be he's a sort of faded football hero and an alcoholic, and he's supposed to look a little bit. He's supposed to look a little faded and a little past it. Granted, I'm not complaining. If that's the way, men look when they're a little past it, that's fine by me. But but he doesn't look sort of extremely chiseled and But
he totally does. He doesn't have like that like rippling six pack that Sebastian Stan does. But like the span of his shoulders is unbelievable. And I almost could not pay attention during the rest. Like he gave a whole speech that I don't remember because I was thinking about his nipples. And he had a shirt on at that point.
All right.
It also should be said that Ben Walker is not just shirtless in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. He's like in a towel for the entire first act. And so there's just like a lot to look at in that show.
He spends a lot of time managing the towel and making sure that his meat and two veg do not show to the audience, which is sort of interesting and distracting and interesting and distracting.
So, more about Cat. What else did you think about the show, so we can get a review in here as well as the bare-chested men?
You know, I have to say, I think a lot, whenever Scarlett Johansson is on Broadway, I feel like a lot is going to be made of that, because she's obviously a big movie star and is one of the main reasons why people go see it. I actually think she's giving a very good performance in this, but I was saying to someone that I feel similarly about this performance, the way I felt about her in A View from the Bridge, is I feel like she is utterly serviceable and totally gets the job done. And I walk out of the theater like, yeah, that was good. But I don't walk out of the theater thinking, wow, that was one of the greatest, most wonderful performances I've ever seen. I feel like she's a totally serviceable Maggie, and you really kind of get the sense that she is this kind of frustrated that all of her sort of that her sexuality is sort of bottled, that she's withholding. Like, you get that sense in the show, but I didn't walk out of there like, man, hand her the Tony Award right now. That was genius. You know, I thought it was good, not great. Yeah. And I actually kind of feel that way about the whole revival. I feel like the production is entertaining in the sense that Tennessee Williams can play like a juicy soap opera, where here's this family with all these problems and everybody drinks and everyone has secrets. And, you know, it's this sort of steamy Southern setting. And it's interesting in the way that a TV show about all of those things would be. But do I feel like, you know, it is a towering piece of theater that bowled me over and made me weep? I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
I think actually Golden Boy is better, if that's what if you're looking for an experience where you walk out of the theater and say, you know, a kind of a real wow. I think Golden Boy is that show, and this cat isn't necessarily.
This cat is, I think, pretty uneven in terms of, like, they're just giving, I think, performances on different levels. It feels like to me, like, Scarlett is giving one performance in, like, one version of Cat, and everybody else is giving performances in another version of Cat. And Scarlett's is very bottled and internal and fraught, and everybody else is playing much bigger. And so it makes for a little bit of unevenness, which makes it hard to really love and rave about the production, even though there were some really great moments and some fantastic performances within. I think it was just uneven.
Well, I haven't seen it yet, but I you know, it sounds to me like maybe the mark of not a strong director, and just based on past efforts, yeah. I you know, it seems to me that certainly that Rob Ashford is not, I mean, his forte is not directing actors in that sense, although he's been doing a lot more directing of straight plays, so I'm not quite sure what that's all about.
Love Him in England.
Yeah. You know, actually, I would say I have seen Picnic, and I would say pretty much the same thing. I think it is quite well directed overall, but it's a very honorable production. There's nothing terribly wrong with it, not remotely. It just doesn't make quite the impact that you would hope. Although I will say I never quite liked this play as much as Inge's other work. I don't know if it's aged as well as his others. I really love Bus Stop and Dark at the Top of the Stairs, for example. But it's I mean, it's definitely worth seeing, especially if you've never seen it before. There are some extraordinary performances in supporting roles, really great people like Elizabeth Marvel and Ellen Burstyn and Mare Winningham in her Broadway debut, I'm very happy to say, finally. And Ben Rappaport, who I'm not that familiar with, is wonderful as Alan, and Reed Birney as Howard. And I have to say, I thought Maggie Grace was really quite extraordinary in the very difficult role of Madge. I think that's one of... I think it's a very difficult role because of just the way it's written. I mean, she's sort of this unknowing, femme fatale almost. You know, she doesn't quite realize the effect she has on people and the way she reacts to Hal, this guy who comes in out of nowhere, you know, and how she decides whether she's going to go with him or stay with the good guy, you know, the nice boy next door, Alan. I thought she was great and also really extraordinarily beautiful. So some people have said that they felt that she didn't have a lot of chemistry with Sebastian Stan, but I don't agree. I did think that in the beginning, but then as soon as they danced together, I felt a lot of chemistry, and I think it's fine if we don't really feel it until that point. I don't think we necessarily have to see it right at the beginning. I think it's more interesting, actually, if it develops over the course of the play. So I thought they had chemistry, and I think it's that she did a wonderful, wonderful job. And Sebastian, although he maybe was not perfect for the part in some ways, one thing I really liked is that he seemed very young. And I think that's important for the role too. When I've seen it played by people far too old for the role, most notably William Holden in the movie, who's literally about 15 years too old for it. And it just doesn't work for the story because of what this guy is supposed to represent. He's only supposed to be a few years out of school. So I recommend this Picnic, even though it's far from perfect. I think it's a very solid production and definitely worth seeing.
All right. You guys keep on talking about Sebastian. I keep on thinking about Sebastian Lacaze.
Oh my goodness. I love Sebastian Lacaze so much. I saw the Rocky Horror Show in 2000 or 2001, whenever that was. I think it was 2000.
12 at the time?
I was not 12 at the time, but
thank you.
But thank you. But that was a show that I saw the matinee, walked out and walked back in and bought another ticket for the evening show because I loved it so much. Sebastian Lacaze, one of the reasons, loved him so much.
We should point out that Sebastian was the thing in Rocky Horror, right?
He was. He was very shirtless in that show.
The Thing? I don't think they call him The Thing.
I think it is. I think the character's name is The Thing.
What is he in that?
He's he's Rocky's invention.
He's Rocky. No, he's
Rocky. He is Rocky.
He's Rocky. He's Rocky. And that was some really impressive shirtlessness. And that was very impeccable shirtlessness that had very much spent a lot of time in the gym and was potentially oiled up. It was like very detailed. But yeah, that was a great show. I love that show.
If you're looking for Sebastian these days, you can go to hustling.tv, hustling.tv, which is an online web series that he is directing and producing. And he funded it through Kickstarter, and he's doing a lot of great work there. But he is, shall we say, hustling. In a legal way.
Yes,
in a legal way.
By the way, Ryan Steele's movie Five Dances was also funded through Kickstarter.
That's right, a lot
of that going on. Yeah.
Yes, for good and for evil. Yes.
Yeah.
Cannot get away from the Kickstarter, please, at this point in the game. If you follow anything related to theater, somebody is in your face wanting help to fund some project that they feel passionately about. It's crazy.
Yes.
Yeah. The Sebastians, I guess it comes along with the name, that you have to spend some good time in the gym and have some good genes.
Unless you're Sebastian Cabot.
I don't know Sebastian Cabot.
I hear silence because I'm so much older than the rest of you. Sebastian Cabot was on the show, was most famous for the TV show Family Affair years ago with Johnny Whitaker, and he played Mr. French, and he was a middle-aged, portly British character actor. Anyone? Hello?
Nope. Sorry.
Nothing.
Well, maybe some of our audience will know who I'm talking about.
are any of you guys fans of Downton Abbey?
Yes.
Obsessed.
Well, it sort of feels like we could actually transition. It seems like there's a lot of overlap between Broadway audiences and Downton Abbey, and I'm wondering why that is. What do you think about that?
Good taste.
Oh, okay. I guess that settles it.
No, I think a lot of theater fans, at least that I know of, all really like period pieces and period dress and all that. I mean, a man in a pair of high-waisted period dress pants just makes me swoon. So I think that's a little bit of that overlap there.
I think you just described Fiero. I mean, that's like half the leading men on Broadway.
Pair of high-waisted pants, it makes your shoulders look nice and strapping and... a little morning jacket, beautiful.
When?
You know when I'm just thinking we haven't seen a musical of, or have we? Not on Broadway, Wuthering Heights.
Oh, I'd go see that.
I know you would.
Like, somebody go write it.
Now, I sort of feel like there is one,
isn't there?
There might have been a London production. There was Jane Eyre, and we almost had Rebecca in We may almost have it again. I mean, it, in the sense of like blustery English, Crazy Wife in the Attic musicals, like, you know.
We had The Secret Garden, which was kind of in that period, but that wasn't about the men. That was about
dead people.
Mandy Patinkin was cute back then. But...
although I did see Mandy Patinkin and Robert Westerberg in that. And even at 9, I think I knew what was up.
Now, Mandy Patinkin was shirtless in the original cast of Evita.
Was he?
Yeah.
God damn it. How did I miss that?
And when he rips off his shirt in the middle of...
right. When he says, if I take off my shirt.
Yeah.
And he thinks I'm Jean Valjean?
You know, you two, or maybe it was just one of you, was on before you could talk about Les Mis.
Yes, it was me. It was Aileen.
It was Aileen, but you haven't spoken about it, and we've spoken about it so much, but could you give us a minute on it? On what?
Speaking of men in period dress.
Yeah.
OMG, that's my review.
Okay.
The thing that I will say about Les Mis is that attempting to review Les Mis as someone who has loved Les Mis since the age of 11 is sort of completely pointless. I mean... like, am I really going to sit here and be like, hey, the whole movie looks like it was shot as like, you know, like Eddie Redmayne was holding his cell phone out with his arm and filming himself. But what does my soul gain by saying that? Nothing. So I'm just going to say, like, Aaron Tveit's beautiful. I completely cried about 8,000 times. And, you know, it did what it needed to do in my life personally. And I feel like it probably did for a lot of other Les Mis fans out there.
I got I got an email from some folks because I have talked about that I'm a fan of Les Mis, but my wife really didn't like it, and they were wondering what she thought of the movie. And I have to say that my wife adored the movie; she loved it, and she loved Russell Crowe. And I was like,
What?
she thought that he walked on water.
So she doesn't like the show version, and she adored the movie?
Exactly.
That's a very uncommon response as far as...
Well, I think that you and I are we have a different audience. We know musical theater people who are in love with the show and hated the movie, and then I think the rest, I mean, they broke $200 million or $250 million in grosses so far. I mean, you can't even challenge it. It's a hit. It's a huge hit. And
I think that the movie itself does in places solve some of the issues with the material by going back to the book. It really kind of cleans up some of the questions and weird hanging, dangling bits in the musical, the stage version of the musical. So I can see how it would make sense that this kind of works a little better for them.
What are some of the changes from the musical to the movie that were made for you that were impressive to you? I have one specific one, but I want to hear what you guys say first.
I mean, I like how they clarified the political situation of the revolution itself, whereas I feel like in the musical, that's quite unclear. I mean, I went to see the stage show, I guess, within the last year in London. And as I was watching it, and I've seen it a number of times and I love the show, I was sitting there and I was like, you know, if you just walked into this, you'd be like, who the hell is General Lamarck? Like, who's that guy? You know? And I think the film really clarifies the political situation around that. And I also think the scale of the revolution is very well handled. Whereas if you see it on stage, you think that like you're watching the French Revolution and, you know, it's, it, you know, whereas in reality, this is a bunch of students rioting in the street, a very small number, and that they failed. And in the film, you really see why they fail. It's like a bunch of people throwing their kitchen tables into the street. Like, that's why they failed. And you really see that very clearly in the movie. And I really like that. The level of intimacy that the film kind of provides around the barricade and the students, there's a lot of clarity around that that I think isn't there, where the musical feels very grandiose. I mean, the barricade gets its own entrance music. It doesn't in the movie. And I like that.
Although I will say, I thought that was a little misleading at the very beginning, because I saw it twice, to make sure that I was correct. As soon as the movie starts, there's a title card that says something like, 35 years after the beginning of the French Revolution. And then it says, a king is back on the throne, or something like that. But I don't know why they didn't say 25 years after the end of the French Revolution, because that did make it sound to me that maybe some people would think that the main French Revolution, quote unquote, was still going on, which is not the case. So that, I think, was a little misleading. But I do agree with you that that in general that it was more clarified, and I think a major improvement was moving the position of I Dreamed a Dream. Because in the show, we barely have met Fantine, and we only hear her sing a few lines, and then she sings the song. And as effective as it is on stage, because the song is so effective, I think it's much better, you know, if we get to know her more and see her really, you know, just really falling and having these tremendously horrible things happen to her, and then she sings it. So I think that was a vast improvement.
Did you guys see Anne Hathaway on The Daily Show? No?
No, I didn't.
She was very, very funny, and she talked about how many times they shot I Dreamed a Dream, and that they actually they shot it, I want to say, a ridiculous number of times, and they used one of the very early takes. And by the end of the shooting, they shot the whole song inside a casket where she sang inside this casket, and halfway through it she was like, yeah, that really doesn't work. But they talked about how the shooting process during the movie went, and it was very interesting. Two other things that I thought were very that worked really well in the movie that I think could be used in the stage show is the relationship of Marius with his father, that is not in the stage show, and that he's got that quick little scene in the beginning when the students are getting together, and then the focus on the rich young boys who are coming to play, and then finally the coming home to his father at the end after the barricade fell. The other thing that I thought was very moving was the scene where Javert, Russell Crowe, was looking over the dead students, and he came upon Gavroche and put his medal on Gavroche. And I thought that was very, very touching. What did you
guys? I'm sorry. When I experienced it, I had the same thought you did, but then I have to say I thought about it afterwards, and I don't know if that really fits in with Javert's character.
Well, I know exactly what you're saying, but I thought it was more humanizing to him.
Oh, absolutely. Maybe it's supposed to show that he's starting to realize that this black and white view he has of the world, you know, that everyone is either good or bad.
Yeah.
Maybe he's starting then to realize that that's not true.
I mean, I think that seeing just Gavroche's death, period, in the film was remarkable in that many of the deaths were because it was so close up, and you don't get that with a stage musical. Even when you're in the front row, there's a kind of distance that you have in a theater and that in a movie. I mean, watching Hadley Fraser playing the French soldier shoot Enjolras, or watching them shoot Gavroche, it was very intimate in the loss of these characters. And that, I think, was really a big impact from the film that you just can't get on the stage.
Yeah, I imagine that when Aaron Tveit was shot in the face and went flying out a window, that you girls must have been kind of, you know, very upset about.
It's both the greatest and the most horrible moment in the whole movie, because, I mean, well, for us anyway, because that scene of Enjolras hanging backwards over the barricade from the stage version is one of the most iconic kind of moments of that show. Everybody knows what that moment is when they see it, even if you just see like a photograph of it. So we were like, how are they going to kill Gavroche? How are they going to kill Enjolras? And when it actually happened, we were like, all right, that's a pretty good way to do it. So yeah.
I almost screamed in joy and simultaneous horror and sadness.
Yeah, if you got to do it, that's the way to do it, you know?
But there was a moment in the movie where Javert punches Enjolras in the face.
Yeah.
And that moment, I was like, not in the face! In the movie theater, I was like, everybody hates me right now. Like, help, it's too beautiful. Don't do that.
Oh, that's funny. And I was, when I went to go see it, our movie theater was packed with teens who were not with their parents and very excited and into the show, and I thought it was great for Broadway and it was great for musical theater. So we'll see if that translates anything.
Well, they're bringing it back.
Yeah. Oh, you know, and the other thing I almost forgot to mention was that I read that they are going to be performing a number on the Oscars.
Yes.
What kind of craziness is that?
Well, I mean, I think we have had to have, you know, Glee on the Tony Awards. I'd say it's about damn time.
Yeah. No, I'm being facetious when I'm saying the craziness. I mean, I think it's going to be great.
Well, I think Cameron McIntosh basically controls the world. Sorry, Sir Cameron McIntosh basically controls the world, and he can have what he wants.
But also, I think whoever it was, Aileen or Laura, was referring to aren't there rumors that the tour of Les Mis may now come into back to Broadway.
They're and they're sitting it down in Toronto in September with rumored casting of Ramin Karimloo as Jean Valjean, which I will be in Toronto for the entire run.
Ramin is the guy who played the Phantom in the Phantom
Love Never Dies.
Love Never Dies in the London production or the Australian production?
In London, and he also played Jean Valjean in London. That's immediately true. Following that. And he actually also played the Phantom in the anniversary concert that they did at the Royal Albert Hall in the last year. So he's a bit of a thing. And I actually saw him in Love Never Dies, and I will not say this about the show, but he's pretty wonderful. So that would be pretty exciting if we could have him on Broadway.
Well, I have to ask Aileen and Laura, Cameron McIntosh has already stated that if Les Mis, the film, was a hit, which it obviously is, that the next project would be Miss Saigon. So I thought I would invite you to cast the show, the movie, and particularly the role of Chris.
Well, it's really funny because I feel like they've been talking about a movie version of Miss Saigon for like 20 years, like for so long. But there were actually rumors a couple of years ago that Ramin Karimloo would play Chris in Miss Saigon in a movie version of it. And he'd be really wonderful, but I don't know that he's like a little too old at this point to potentially play it. I do have an entire dream cast for Miss Saigon, don't I? Who is my dream Chris? It was what's his name who was in American Idiot. I'm sorry. I apologize for calling him what's his name. It's just because of Karimloo.
Oh,
Van Hughes?
Yes, Van Hughes, I thought would be great. He replaced Johnny Gallagher in American Idiot. I do not think Johnny Gallagher would be a great Chris, for the record.
Van Hughes has a nice strapping chest. He could do it.
And he has that kind of sensitive yet tough kind of thing going on.
I thought you were going to say Stark Sands.
Oh, Stark Sands would be good too, actually. I mean, he, you know, and not just because we just saw him playing soldier in American Idiot. I'd go see that movie too.
I think Jeremy Jordan could do Sensitive But Tough. I mean, I think that's his whole gig as Jack Kelly. So that's true. I'd be mad about that.
Yeah,
I think the camera loves him.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I'd go see that as well.
All right. So I didn't get your fill in very quickly before we wrap up here. What was your take on Russell Crowe?
Well,
I personally thought that his singing was not the right. He did not have the right voice for the role, but I was not mad about his acting. I don't think he was an overall bummer. I just think he wasn't vocally where I would have wanted Javert to be.
Yeah. I also think that the singing was just kind of not what. Yeah, not the singer that Javert should be. But also, I think I do have to say that I love the moment. Oh, this is such a big spoiler. Am I allowed to say like crazy spoilers?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. It's been out for a month. You know,
that's true. I do kind of love the sound effect when he commits suicide and you actually kind of hear him crack in half. I was like, wow, that's amazing.
My wife commented on that too. Why'd they have to do that? They didn't need to do. He could have just fell into a big thing of water. Why did he have to hit cement or stone?
Dead.
Think about that for a minute. What did they use in like After Effects to make that noise? Like what did they drop on something in a studio to make the Russell Crowe cracks in half noise?
Like a watermelon?
A friend of mine asked that question. He said, I don't know what it was, but whatever it was, it sure sounded exactly like a body hitting, you know, stone in water from a height of 200 feet or whatever.
I think that they just used a recording of Russell Crowe throwing a concierge off the balcony of his hotel room.
Oh,
You did.
If you were able to go back in a time machine and cast that role, do you have somebody you would have put into that role?
To be honest with you,
other than Russell Crowe.
To be honest with you, I would put Hugh Jackman in that role. I think he's not vocally right for Jean Valjean, and I think it's more in his range to play Javert.
It's a lot of people have said that. Yeah,
he has a big, strapping, beautiful chest. He would be a wonderful Javert. But then I don't know who I would put in as Jean Valjean. If we flop them, I cannot think of a big movie actor who I would pop in to the role of Jean Valjean.
Yeah, that's a hard one.
Yeah. And that's, you know, casting in reality versus casting in my dreams. You know, in my dreams, I'd put in Ramin Karimloo, but that's not going to get a movie made. So how do you replace?
Well, we talked about this a few weeks ago. I don't think that they really needed to put people of – once they had Hugh Jackman, they didn't need anybody else.
Yeah.
I think that Cameron McIntosh is big enough and Les Mis has made enough box office on in the musical theater realm that they didn't need they didn't need anything to get the movie financed. They didn't need Russell Crowe to get it financed.
Right, but as I said, I imagine that the presence of those other people has really pushed it over the top.
Oh, yeah. So let's wrap up here. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If, in fact, you don't want to listen to us on iTunes, you want to listen to us through Stitcher, you can get the Stitcher app, which is for your BlackBerry, your iPhone, and your Android devices. That way you can listen to us on the fly streaming. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Girls, tell us about your new gig at Backstage. What are you going to be writing about? What?
We're going to actually be recapping the second season of Smash, which we're very excited about. That starts in a couple of weeks. And, you know, I think there's a lot of interest in this season among, obviously folks who like Broadway are going to like Smash anyway, but especially for us because Jeremy Jordan is on it and Andy Mientis and some Broadway people who we kind of loved already are just now going to be on TV every week. So it's really exciting. We're excited to do it.
Great, and we can find that at backstage.com. Will it be also linked on Craptacular or maybe on Twitter? You'd be posting links and things like that.
Oh yes. If you'll find it on our Facebook page, you'll find it on our Twitter, and you may find it on our site as well.
Alrighty, Michael. Anything coming up for you this week we should talk about?
Well, I'm seeing Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, so I'm looking forward to that, and that's my main thing for the week.
I forgot to mention at the top of the show that Peter is somewhere. He was going to join us, but the logistics didn't work out because he went out of town to see a show, and I'm sure we'll talk about it next week. But Peter will be back next week. Next week, we're going to have Richard Azunian from the Toronto Star is going to join us as well. And Michael and I will be here as well. So I guess that's about it for right now. So on behalf of Laura Mata and Aileen McKenna and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.